If you want to learn more about the topics of today's episode, visit the podcast website at naturesecretservice.com. Thanks for listening. Okay, people, listen up. Here we go. This is Nature's Secret Service, the podcast that puts you in the room with the men and women of wildlife law enforcement. I'm Ed Newcomer, your host, and welcome back to the first episode of season two of our podcast. With us today, we have an absolutely fantastic guest, Todd Vandevert, a former wildlife officer with the state of Washington. Todd has a really impressive background, and he's got just phenomenal stories about his career in wildlife law enforcement up in the Pacific Northwest. He was a wildlife law enforcement officer for the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife for, get this, 33 years, which is an extremely impressive career in public service. He worked first part of his career as a uniformed patrol officer, and then a second part of his career as a plainclothes detective with the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife. And, you know, in addition to that, he did a lot of what we call in the business collateral duties, which often you're not paid for. It's just, thank you very much for your service. But he was a defensive tactics instructor, a critical incident peer support counselor for the agency, a meth lab tech, a certified polygraph examiner. All of those things are so valuable to other law enforcement officers in his department. And like I said, they're often done as collateral duties for no pay. He really has impressive accolades for his career. I mean, he's one of only two officers in the state of Washington who received the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Statewide Officer of the Year Award, not once, but twice. And his other awards include things like the Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife Case of the Year Award, Detective of the Year Award, and there's just many others. We could have a whole episode about all of the accolades that Todd has. One of the coolest ones, though, this is what I love. He's believed to be one of the first, if not the first, game warden in the United States to build and use a radio-controlled robotic deer decoy. And in the business, what we call those are robo-deers. And Basically, it's a robotic deer you put out in the field. It moves. It might wag its tail or move its head. And it's designed to test whether or not people driving by shoot at it illegally.
Yeah.
Good stuff. And now, of course, those are used all over the country, all over the world. There's robotic deer, elk, moose, wolves, cougars. They have all types. Bears. Yeah, exactly. Anyway, Todd, you've had to be quiet while I introduced you, but welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for being on. It's a real pleasure to finally meet you kind of virtually in person, but thank you for being on. It's my pleasure. I can't wait to talk to you today. One of the things I didn't mention is that since you retired, you've written and published 12 different books related to wildlife conservation issues and law enforcement. And one of those books is Operation Cody. And that's what I want to talk to you about today, because I've read Operation Cody now twice, and it always struck me as such a really cool case. I don't want to give anything away. I want you to tell us about it, but tell us a little bit about the impetus for your undercover operation called Operation Cody. What year did it start, and what gave you the idea to develop a operation like that?
Sure. Every year there's a conference for undercover fish and wildlife officers from around the western states and western provinces of Canada. And I went to one of those years back, and there was a guy that was speaking there, and he was from the East Coast, and he had done a storefront operation. And for those that don't know what a storefront operation is, in the undercover world, it's a business that you create hoping to entice poachers, in this case, into doing business with you. And so the guy that presented this operation to us at the conference had done so as a fish buyer, set up a fish buying business, and it was in a state where the sale of sport caught fish was illegal, and that was his primary target, and it was extremely successful. That really got my brain going, but the one part of it I didn't really care for was the fact that he literally lived it 24/7. I mean, he lived upstairs of the fish business. He, you know, I mean, that's all he did. And I was a dedicated employee, but I didn't want to do that. I've got a family. I just wanted to, you know, be able to go home once in a while. So I started giving a lot of thought to how I could do it my way rather than living it like that. And what I was running a small business on the side, selling law enforcement equipment, law enforcement and firefighting equipment. And I did that by way of the internet, you know, all internet sales, all that kind of stuff. So I started thinking about it, thought, well, why can't I do that with a wildlife operation? Just put up a website and offer to buy and sell things that are legal to buy and sell by Washington law, but might appear tempting to people who are willing to do business illegally. That was the concept, is to make an internet-based business and buy and sell, hopefully, illegal items that we could catch the people that were harvesting them and selling them.
Interesting. And so, what year was this, Todd?
2010 is when it really started taking form.
Okay. And at this time, you were part of, you had transitioned from out of a uniformed role into a plainclothes detective role. What's the unit there at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife? Is it SIU? Is that what they call it?
SIU, Statewide Investigative Unit.
Okay. And so you'd kind of had to make this transition from a person who wore a uniform, drove a marked vehicle every day and did patrol work and, you know, shorter term investigations. Now you're transitioning into this detective work where you can kind of focus on problems or issues that you become aware of, right?
Right.
One of the things I always liked about SIU at Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife is that, like at the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you guys really focused in on, you know, people who were commercializing wildlife.
Right.
Because, you know, that's, as I've described in this podcast in other episodes, you know, that's taking it beyond just like the recreational poacher who gets a little out of control or goes out and kills a deer here and there. You got organized, ongoing activity that's designed specifically to exploit wildlife, which, can really add the numbers up. You know, it's kind of interesting. I want to talk a little bit just briefly about the whole logistics of setting up a business. Cause I did that too in my career and it's a huge pain in the butt. Having your patrol experience and now being a detective kind of dialed in with what's going on in patrol, it's really valuable because you kind of have a sense of what's a problem area, where might we need to focus our attention, which is really one of the reasons I love Operation Cody, because normally when we think about, we talk about operations, it's usually focused on a particular crime network or individual, and we're going after that particular group to try to, you know, as they say, chop the head off the snake and stop that particular group of co-conspirators from engaging in criminal activity. But Operation Cody was designed to really focus on a broad problem. It wasn't focused on an individual. It was focused on like commercialization and wildlife trafficking across species and with multiple potential targets, which I really love, because that is identifying a potential problem within the state, coming up with a solution and then executing, which is, you don't hear about those operations a lot, but they're super effective and they're super needed, I think, sometimes. But you really wouldn't have thought about it if you hadn't been like a former patrol officer yourself and in touch with the patrol division and kind of understanding, I think there's a lot of, you know, bad stuff going on here that we need to address, right? Did you find that doing Operation Cody as an online business made it a little easier for you to kind of control that balance between work life and personal life?
It did, yeah. I still got a lot of phone calls When I set it up, I set up the online presence, but I also, you know, put an email address down and my phone number, my cell phone number. So I still got a lot of after hour calls, and I wasn't going to ignore them, you know, so I took calls, but, it was time consuming for sure, especially since, and I guess we'll get into it in a little bit, but especially since I had almost no help.
How long did it take you were you at all worried, oh, this might not work? I mean, how long did it take you before people started to contact you and hint that they might be interested in either buying or selling illegal wildlife?
I can't give you the exact date, but I think it was in December of 2010. It was just a couple of days after I activated the website. I got a call from a guy, and first thing out of his mouth is, do you buy deer?
Interesting.
And I'm like, it's illegal to buy deer. You know, you can't do that. That's against the law. And of course he said, I know it's illegal. I'm asking you, do you buy it? Are you willing to buy it? And so we did the whole conversation about it and keeping our mouth shut and all that kind of neat stuff. And it was a U.S. Army soldier based at Fort Lewis who was, I think, poaching the deer on base. And he was a significant poacher. I mean, he killed a lot of deer, and he sold all of them. I mean, the guy didn't even know how to gut a deer. He just shot him and sold them.
So he's selling them for what? The everything? The meat, the skin, the antlers?
Whatever you want to buy them for, I guess. But yeah, primarily the meat.
Interesting. And for, you know, for listeners who don't know the Pacific Northwest, there's a huge military base up there. It used to be an Air Force base and an Army base that's since merged.
Still is. They're merged. It's Joint Base Lewis-McChord.
Yeah, Joint Base. But it's huge. And there's so much property up there, heavily wooded property, that you could easily poach animals right off the base and nobody'd probably know.
Well, you dodge the artillery that's coming in.
Right there. Yeah, there are some firing ranges up there.
Yeah, but there is.
Anyway, isn't that interesting that the first person, so your idea is working. You didn't do anything to entrap anybody. You just put this out on the website, and right away, like moths to a flame, the poachers are coming to you. And gosh, the first one out of the box is a U.S. Army soldier who's based at a base. That's crazy. So it must have, that must have been reassuring. Like, okay, I'm on to something here, right?
Yep.
How did it, and for how, like, what was your vision? How long did you think this operation would go on running this business?
I had asked for 2 years, and the reason I asked for 2 years was twofold. One was I knew it would take a while for the word to get out. I mean, you can't just throw a website out and hope people will find it. You have to do some advertising. You have to get the word out. So I knew it would take a while for that. The second thing is the statute of limitation in Washington for a gross misdemeanor. All the crimes that we would be dealing with were, almost all of them were felony level, but some of them were gross misdemeanor. The statute of limitation on gross misdemeanor is 2 years. So I figured that way, everything we get, we can charge. And so that's what I had asked for. That's what the chief told me I could have. It's not what we got, but
So you're off and running with that. Explain, how did you, you talk to this guy, this soldier, we'll just talk about him first and then we'll get into all the other characters you got into. But you, with this soldier, then he's admitted to you, he knows it's illegal. He's willing to move forward. What do you do next? Did you end up buying deer from him?
We did. Yes. He called me in the evening and said that, you know, he's got a deer in the back of his truck and wanted to know if I wanted to buy it. So after going over the whole conversation about the legalities and so forth, I agreed to meet him at the north end of the runways at SeaTac Airport.
Okay. I know that. I know the area well. Okay.
And so he came driving up, no tail lights on his truck, an illegal deer, untagged, closed season, sitting in the open of the bed of his pickup truck.
Unbelievable. That's brazen. And plus, you know, Washington State Patrol troopers on I-5 are pretty diligent. I'm surprised he didn't get pulled over for the taillight issue.
Yeah, well, we had a little talk about that. I said, you know, if you and I are going to do business, you got to be a little bit more careful than that. You know, I mean, So yeah, he wasn't the sharpest tool in the shed. It wasn't one to, you know, go home and brag about. But the guy was a poacher, that's for sure.
And you right there, like a drug deal right there in the parking lot, you did this exchange for an illegal deer right out of the back of his truck?
Yeah, we literally did it right off the end of the runway on the side of a little pull off the side road.
He was not the only person that you were contacted who was selling, you know, game meat like deer and elk and.
No, it became very prevalent.
And you bought from him more than once, right?
Yes.
So it wasn't like he was just a one-time guy. He was doing this to make money.
Yeah.
Who were some of the other people that came up initially? And, you know, how did you work this with the partner you had who was only part-time? How did that play out?
Well, obviously, we couldn't work. We couldn't use Jennifer in the immediate area that she's a uniform officer. The one advantage we had with her is that she had spent her whole career in one spot. And so I had moved three or four times around the state during my career. So, you know, the chances of somebody recognizing me were, I would think, would be higher. Although I can change my appearance by, you know, I grew long hair, had a ponytail and a beard. Women are kind of limited on how much they can change, you know. So we were very conscientious about not using her any place that she might be recognized. But other than that, we knew each other really well. We've been friends a long time. So we, you know, we could walk the talk, you know. It's difficult to fake that you're in a long-term relationship with somebody without knowing a lot about them. So
exactly. And having a certain, you know, camaraderie off of each other. But so that worked out. You knew her well, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. How long did it take you for things to really get rolling? You had this first soldier, and then how did it play out? What other kind of characters came calling?
Well, we did a couple things to get customers. One is did a little bit of advertising, you know, made business cards and brochures, and we spread them all over the place. What we did to get intelligence on people that are potentially doing commercialization in illegal wildlife was we had the chief put out an email to all the regions and say, if you have information about any potentially illegal wildlife trafficking or any form of illegal wildlife violations that are commercial related, send the information in. And so we got quite a bit of information from the regions because game wardens all over. I mean, if you're a state game warden for very long, you hear all kinds of rumors, you know, and some of them are true, some of them are not. But every game warden in the state with much time had something tucked away in their memory or in the back of their notebook or something about, you know, a guy came up and said, hey, I went into a grocery store and they asked me this. So we asked for that. And as I expected, a couple of the regions were very helpful. They sent in a ton of good intel. A couple of the regions didn't even reply whatsoever. So that was part of it. The other part of it was everybody that we did business with, whether it was, and we did a lot of legal business too. Everybody that we did business with, you know, we'd leave them with brochures and all that kind of neat stuff. And so the word started spreading out. But as we got these tips from the uniform officers, we would do statewide tours. And, you know, you've been in the business a long time. We call them cold contacts, where you go into a business, a taxidermist, for example, and you don't know the guy, you've never met him, nobody introduces you, there's no informant. It's just an officer said, I think this guy's dirty. And so, you know, we would go in and strike up a conversation with the person and see where it went. You mentioned entrapment earlier, and that's one of the things we were super concerned about from the beginning is, you know, a lot of people think that undercover as a whole is entrapment. And I'm not an attorney, so nobody take this as law, but my understanding of entrapment, and you can give me yours, is the idea for the crime originated in law enforcement's mind. Law enforcement are the ones that came up with this idea, and it's too tempting for an ordinary citizen to pass up.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and that's a defense that they can raise later. A defendant can raise is that I was entrapped, and then it becomes incumbent on the government to prove they weren't. But the key thing for in the law, just so listeners understand, everybody who's a law enforcement officer will know this, but to defeat a claim of entrapment, all the government has to show is that there was a scintilla of evidence that the person was predisposed.
You have to pre-plan what they're going to do to attack your case. And entrapment was our number one concern. So we never once, I mean, not once did we ever suggest that somebody do something illegal. We didn't say, hey, you know what you ought to do? You ought to kill some elk and give them to me. I mean, no. As a matter of fact, when you read the book, you probably read a couple of times where we told people to stop. You know, just like, you're killing too much. Stop.
I was just going to bring that up as, you know, I was going to bring that up later in our conversation as we talked about how your business got going. Yeah, there were times when you had folks who were excited to have sold to you and they wanted to go out and kill more. And you actually had to put the brakes on a couple of them because they were killing so much you weren't even asking for. They were just, they'd sell something to you and they'd run out and kill something else, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And we had one individual that, we bought elk from that. I don't know how many elk they went through a year, 35 or 40. That's a lot of elk. And he sold elk every week. There's just no way to get somebody like that to stop. He had tons of buyers. We were only one of his buyers. So
was that the character in your book you describe as a guy named Bori? Is it Bori?
Yep.
Yeah. Yep. Bori. But let's talk about Bori for a second, because how did you get on to Bori? I don't want to give away too much for the book because I want people to buy it and read it because it's a great read. But Bori was kind of an interesting character. He's a little bit funny, a little bit scary, but he was an Asian guy, right?
Yes, Cambodian.
Cambodian. Okay, so he's interesting to me for a lot of reasons, but how did he come to your attention? How'd you connect up with Bori?
That was a really odd one. This guy called our office in Olympia, told our headquarters office that he knew of a guy that was selling deer and elk, all you could buy, but he only dealt with Asian people. So we're like, okay. So it, you know, once I called the guy back myself, the reporting party, which is a little bit hazardous because if he recognized my voice in the later, but anyway, so I called the guy back and I picked his brain and he said, yeah, I've got this number you can call. And I said, well, what's the guy's name? And he's, I don't know. A friend of mine buys elk from him. And I asked him how he does it. And he says, you just call this number and tell him you want an elk. And so I said, oh, okay. So I did the reverse directory trying to find out whose number that was. And it came back as no record, you know, and I was totally out of luck. So I just called the guy myself. And no, I didn't try and fake an Asian accent. I just,
no, that would be stupid. Just go, yeah. You just gotta count on these people being greedy, right? Which they are.
Yeah. So I called him and the conversation probably lasted less than a minute. I called up and said, this is my name. This is my business name. I said, do you have internet? And he goes, yep. And I said, look up our website on the internet. Call me back if you're interested. And that's where I left it, because on our website, we had a lot of antlers. Antlers in Washington, you can buy and sell them. That's fine. And so we had a lot of antlers on there, deer and elk both. But we also had elk meat for sale, because Washington law allows the sale of elk meat if it's raised in a licensed game farm in another state or another country. Most of what they get in Washington is red deer from New Zealand. So, you know, if you go to a restaurant and they say it's an elk tenderloin, that's most likely what it is a red deer tenderloin from New Zealand. They're farm raised. But we had that on there. So he looked on that, called back and said, okay, I want to meet you guys. You know, I don't know who you are, so I need to meet and talk to you and all that. Okay, great. Where are we going to meet? Well, give me a day that you're going to be around. And he's from Tacoma and south of Seattle. And he said, give me a day that you're going to be around the area. So we did. And he said, I'll give you instructions on where to meet me when you get close.
Okay, so, classic.
So called him up and said, we're coming into Tacoma. Where do we meet? And he gave us his home address. And his home address wasn't in the nicest neighborhood.
There's some parts of Tacoma that are pretty dodgy, that's for sure.
Yeah, and that's one of them. So we went in there. There was four or five Cambodian men hanging around. He had us, we had assigned seating. He told us to sit on this little short couch, and he sat in a easy chair in front of us. And then he had these four or five guys behind us. And the only weapon that I saw as we went in was a sword, and it was on the counter behind us. And so basically what he did is interviewed us, and he did a pretty good job. It became obvious to me pretty quickly that he had looked up our business online. You can, you know, get under the Department of Licensing and look to see if you have a business license, which I did, which we did. And it comes back to you talking about setting up a business. Had I not taken that step, that might have been a problem right there. He also, and this is really common, offered us a beer. And I don't remember what time of day it was, but I had quit drinking a couple of years before that. And I wasn't about to start again. So I just said, nope, I don't drink. That really bothered him. He's like, eh. So Jennifer volunteered to have a beer. And so she had a beer, and that made him feel a whole lot better. At one point, he said he wanted more business cards or brochures. I don't know which. And so he sent me out to the truck to get more. And I knew what he was doing is he's going to ask her questions while I'm gone. And then he's going to ask me the same question when I come back in. And he was good at it. I mean, he really was. And he said at the end of our deal, I said, well, are we going to do business? He said, I'll let you know. I'm like, okay. So I thought, well, that's it. We're not getting the call back. We didn't pass the interview. And God, we're driving down the road 15, 20 minutes later, phone rings and it's him. And he said, I don't remember exactly, but it was something like, I'll have three elk for you on Thursday, this much money, cash only, see you then. And so that's how that started. And we did business with him for the entire, you know, year and a half.
Yeah, he's a regular character. Once he got started and, you know, you passed his test, he became a regular character. And one of the things that struck me about him is, you know, you mentioned he's Cambodian and, you know, he likes to work with people he knows from the Asian community. So, and other times, you know, I believe you saw a lot of weapons at Barry's house over the course of the investigation, right? Including assault rifles and things like that.
And he described shooting somebody to us too. So, yeah.
So, but interestingly, I want to ask you, you know, he didn't like dealing with non-Asians, but in the investigation, you found out he was getting on some of his deer and elk from tribal members, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So he's interconnected with tribal members who have very unique, I mean, and special hunting rights in Washington, but they're not allowed necessarily to go then and go sell them meat.
Right.
And the other thing he was into was sturgeon as well, right?
Sturgeon, cockfighting, and marijuana grows.
So he didn't like working with Asians, but he had to get sturgeon and to be involved in, you know, salmon and sturgeon and deer and elk. He's working with a lot of people who aren't Asians. So he really was a true trafficker.
Yeah. Yeah. He's pretty good at it. Pretty active. Yep.
But over time, I think he actually got to like you, didn't he?
He did. Yeah. He always referred to me as his favorite white boy. As soon as I come in the room, he'd go, oh, my favorite white boy.
You know you're in when that happens, right?
Yeah.
So that's so far we talked about stuff going on the western side of the state. Did you get into people across Washington and eastern Washington or any of the neighboring states?
We basically ended up across the country. We did business with New York, Chicago, California.
I think Oklahoma too, right?
Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Canada, BC. And that was one of the things early on when we first got approval to do it. And I met with the deputy chief, and the deputy chief and my captain spelled out a couple of the rules. And one of them was no working with the feds.
I wanted to get to that. Having been a fed myself.
And no doing business with tribal members. Oh, there's three. No interstate. And I'm like, because that would involve the feds. And so I argued till I was blue in the face with them. That I'm like, you can't have a website and do business just in this state. You know, I mean, that doesn't make sense.
You are going to get contacted by people all over the country. Yeah.
And the tribal stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, that was just plain frustrating because we got a lot of offers from tribal members that we just said, nope, not interested, can't do it. Those are the rules that were put on us and we still went about doing business. And some of the rules got changed.
So, we've talked a lot about the, you know, Western Washington and deer and elk and all that. Did you ever, I do remember in the book, there's a couple of restaurants that were involved too. There was more than one. It's not like one restaurant wanted to buy from you, but multiple restaurants, right?
Yeah, we had, and again, I can't remember off the top of my head, five or six different restaurants that we dealt with. And those came about by uniform officers telling us that they had heard, you know, that this restaurant buys. Well, I used one that was in Tri-Cities. The initial thing we got was that they were buying waterfowl and serving it at the restaurant.
Yeah, for ducks on the menu, right? Which is,
yeah,
that goes, that kind of pokes a nerve for a wildlife officer, because knowing the history of decimation of waterfowl in this country in the early 20th century, you know, that to know that market hunting of ducks still goes on is kind of a sore spot. But
yeah.
And then of course you have safety issues, right? You have unknown meat going to restaurants that's sold to the public. That's an issue.
And that's one of the things that concerned both Jennifer and myself, is that we're selling meat that we got from poachers, and most of them are drug addicts. We got meat that we got from poachers, and then we turn around and sell that same meat to a restaurant who then prepares it and sells it to their customers. And I was a little bit concerned about, you know, somebody getting sick and, you know, going after the state for their involvement in providing this uncertified meat or uninspected meat.
Yeah, the last thing you want when you walk into a restaurant is to know that the meat you're eating was handled by a methamphetamine user and dealer, right?
Yeah, well, that's probably more common than we believe, but I was concerned about that. We asked our captain to run it by the Attorney General's office and see what they had to say, and I normally don't look forward to a decision from the Attorney General's office, but that one I wanted to know. And they came back and said, if we had reason to believe that they were already engaged in buying and preparing and selling game meat in the restaurant, that we were good to go as long as we used every due care and caution to make sure that it was safe and edible.
Yeah. And this whole restaurant thing, though, kind of blew up on you, right? Because we're not just talking about the kind of meats that you ordinarily might see in a restaurant, which might be deer or elk or salmon, certainly. But this led to like some crazy stuff, like people buying whole bears from you and cougars. And
yeah,
tell us about that. Like, that was Eastern Washington restaurants, I believe. But tell us about that. Like, what did you think when you got it? You start getting inquiries where a guy wants to buy a whole bear from you. And why would they want a whole bear?
It's funny because that the the bear and mountain lion were one individual with one restaurant in particular. And the story is kind of strange. When I was a uniform officer in the Blue Mountains, two of our other officers in a different area had been approached by a guy that worked for a beverage company, Pepsi or Coca-Cola, and he delivered to restaurants and stores. And he had gone into this one particular restaurant, a Chinese restaurant, and he walked into the cooler to put the soda in the cooler for him, and there was three or four deer laying on the floor of the cooler. And he thought, well, that's interesting, and he's a hunter, so he called up those officers and said, this is what I saw. I don't know why I wasn't involved in it, don't know a thing about it, but they never went. They didn't go look at the restaurant. They didn't inspect. As far as I know, they never looked at it. And so we were coming back from a contact in Oregon, and we were coming through Walla Walla where this restaurant was. And so we stopped in and gave them a brochure and a card. This is the same place that had been reported for having a bunch of illegal deer. And that night, I went back and I was, I got to back up a little bit. I'm sorry. So the guy at the restaurant wasn't there. The owner of the restaurant wasn't there. The people that I dealt with didn't speak they spoke very little English. And so they said they'd have him call. Well, the guy finally did call. And that was one of the most entertaining conversations I had, because he looked at our brochure and he said, I see you sell bear. And, you know, I put on there that we sell bear hides because you can legally do that, you know, and he said, I see you sell bear. And I said, yeah. And he said, well, what parts of bear do you have? And I said, well, what part are you looking for? And he wouldn't say it. There's these people that think that if I say it, then, you know, I'm in trouble. So he wouldn't say what he was looking for. I knew what he was looking for, but he said, what parts do you sell? So I started naming every part of a bear I could think of. And I went from the claws to the paws, to the teeth, to the tail, to the, you know, the ear. I mean, I did everything. Heart, liver, da, da, da. Finally, I said gallbladder, and he goes, oh, you have gallbladder?
Acting said, yeah. Surprised. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Well, let me try those. So he asked me to bring over one gallbladder for him to test. And so I brought over one gallbladder, sold it to him for whatever, and $50 or something, because it was his test drive one. It was a real small one. And that night I was by myself. Jennifer didn't go on the second one. And so I was by myself. So that night I stayed at Corky Roberts' house with Corky and his wife.
Special Agent Corky Roberts with U.S. Yeah. Fish and Wildlife Service. So much for not cooperating with the feds.
Yeah, well, so I'm sitting in his house when this guy calls back. And this is the day that I sold him the one to test. And the guy called back and he said, your gallbladder turned out to be bear. So, you know, I'm happy. And he said, I want to buy more. Said, how many do you want? And he goes, how many do you have? And I said, more than you can afford. And he said, no, I'll buy all of them that you've got. And we set a price, and that was it. And I mean, it was so fun having that conversation in front of Corky and his wife, the very Fed that would be working it later. And I'm sitting in his living room having this conversation with a guy that wants to buy all the gallbladder I can get him.
And the crazy thing is, where's that gallbladder going? Yeah.
According to him, it was going to Hong Kong.
Yep. So you go from like a restaurant buying occasional salmon fillets or deer meat. Now you're into this Asian guy who's interested in all the gallbladders you can get. What is the price of a gall? What were you charging him for your gallbladders?
You know, with him, I ended up going per gram, and I don't remember the price per gram. That, you know, yeah, normally we would sell them between $100 and $200 a piece.
Yeah. Yeah. And that adds up if you're talking, you know, all you've got
25 or 30. Yeah.
Yeah. And where were you getting them? Where did you source your gallbladders when you were selling them to this guy?
So we had hound hunters that were out there on special permits to kill problem bears. And that's where we got the bear gallbladder from. And it wasn't all the timber company stuff. When bears would terrorize the garbage cans in Issaquah or whatever, then those bear too, if they got put down, we'd take the gallbladder out of them too.
Yeah. Lots of opportunities for you to lawfully come across. It could be a seized bear. It could be all kinds of situations where you could come across a bear. Okay. That's interesting. But now, you know, that guy became kind of an interesting character because he had connections in Oregon as well, right?
He had connections all over the place. Yes. He had connections in Oregon. He sent us down to Oregon to sell bear. We shipped whole bear. I remember right before Christmas, we shipped a whole frozen bear. It had been chopped up, but the whole thing was in the box. And we shipped it, I think, to part of it to Chicago and part of it to New York, if my memory serves me right, which probably doesn't. But anyway, we shipped them by UPS. And I remember asking him, I said, I'm shipping these. He's paying for the shipping. And I said, you want them shipped, second day, I assume. And he's like, no, just regular UPS. And I said, you know, it's Christmas, right? I mean, Christmas is in a week or two. And he goes, yeah. And I said, so things are kind of slow. So I'm just worried about it thawing out. And he said, nope, send it UPS. I'm like, okay. So I did. And I stewed about that for a long time thinking that, kids are going to open up their Christmas presents on Christmas and they're going to smell really funny because these rotting bear carcasses in the stack of packages above them was leaking down onto their package. But ironically, they got to their destinations and they were still frozen. So dodged a bullet.
Did you have any, did he tell you, what are they doing with a whole bear? I mean, there's the gallbladder, but this was weird about this guy that struck me when I read the book is he wanted the whole bear. What are they doing with the whole bear?
Well, it kind of goes back to, we delivered him a whole mountain lion one time, about 160 pound cat. It was a big tom. One of our uniform officers seized it from a guy. The guy that they seized it from hadn't gutted it, and it was probably 4 days old at that point, so it stunk really bad. And I called the same restaurant owner up and said, and he had asked us before, if you get a mountain lion, I want the whole thing. I'm like, okay. I called him up and said, I have a lion, it's been gutted, but the whole thing. And he goes, I'll take it. And I said, it stinks. I mean, I think it's spoiled. He goes, I'll still take it. And okay. So we sold it to him for, $500 or $600, something like that, for a stinking mountain lion. And we pulled away from that. And I was confused. I remember turning around to Jennifer saying, I don't get it. The guy can buy pork for a tenth that price, so why is he paying so much for a mountain lion to serve to his customers instead of just serving it as pork, which is what he would portray it as? And she said, I don't think it's going to his regular customers. And I go, what do you mean? She goes, I think it's going to Asian customers only, because several of them told us that eating the meat or parts of the powerful predators, whether it's mountain lion, I don't know if they believe it with wolves or not, but mountain lions and bears especially, gives them energy and strength. So,
and it's just, yeah. And then, they can, with cats in particular, big cats, they'll melt down the bones and make, what they call tiger bone wine, but tigers are getting so scarce that they've turned to other big cats. But it's just weird because it's a reminder that there's a lot of people out there who commercialize wildlife for reasons that we don't normally contemplate, right? There may be other motivations going on here that you never even thought of when you started Operation Cody, right?
Exactly.
We're kind of getting short on time a little bit, so I need to jump ahead a little. I'll just say that, Operation Cody, the book that you wrote, is a very natural, fun read. And it's hard to write a book that tells the story about this case because there's so many different suspects, so many different types of animals, so many unique, funny, scary, dangerous contacts that you had. So, you know, people should go get your book and read it because you walk us through that whole operation pretty smoothly. But let's fast forward now, Todd, maybe to a year and a half in of your 2-year op. I think that everybody was kind of blown away by the success of your operation. Because correct me if I'm wrong here, Todd, but let me just summarize. By the time you're at about a year and a half into this 2-year op, you've got like 100 suspects and 1,000 potential counts. I think by the end of the whole thing, as you describe in your book, you and Jennifer had like 600 undercover contacts during this op. I think what happened is the senior leadership was like, holy shit, this is a big deal. And that raises all kinds of other questions of naturally, we got to bring in some other agencies to help us get this done. But what I want to get into next, Todd, is when you're at that point, it's not just doing the case and having these 600 contacts and developing 100 suspects and 1,000 counts. You got to now start thinking about how we're going to prosecute these people, right? So you've got huge evidence issues. You have huge like report writing issues that now are going to face you as you come to a close. Can you kind of explain to listeners like what that was like as you're wrapping this up now? What was the state of your evidence control and your report writing and all of that? I mean, that must have just been a nightmare.
Yeah, it's the detective that they first assigned to assist in that capacity. Nice guy, you know, smart enough, all that kind of neat stuff. But they tasked him with working shellfish investigations and also doing, you know, helping with our stuff, with our evidence and all that.
Well, I think it was just, you know, how did you deal with at this point, they're wrapping it up. How did you cope with the, you know, did you have evidence issues, report issues? How did that all play out?
Well, when it came down to, we've got this date, we've got to be ready, we've got to get all the prosecutors' packages all ready, I grabbed all the case files and I opened them up, and the guy that had done them made a really nice little tab, you know, that are all typed out and stuff. I mean, the folders look really cool, but when I opened them up, the only thing in the folders at all was my case report and Jennifer's case report. Nothing else. There was no background information. There was no evidence forms or nothing. And so then I found out that almost none of the evidence had been tested.
Oh boy. Tested at a lab, you mean? Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, like, we're seizing raptor feathers from hawks, eagles, owls. And I can't stand it. I can't get up on the stand and say I'm an expert on raptors and I can tell you for sure this is from a snowy owl. No.
Exactly. You know it. You're experienced enough. You know it in the field. But for proving something in court beyond a reasonable doubt does require those expert witnesses to say, this is what this is, confirming what it is. And that has to come from a forensics lab.
And bear gallbladder looks identical to pig gallbladder. As a matter of fact, I think it's been done many times where people get pig gallbladder and sell them to Asian buyers as bear gallbladder. But since they look identical, the only way to tell them apart is by DNA testing. So, you know, we had a bunch of testing left to do. Well, it hadn't been done. And, so it was a mess. It was an absolute total mess. So they, then at the last, you know, the last few months of the operation, they hired, they put in another officer, Julie Cook, as a temporary detective. So we had, Jennifer was assigned to be full-time at that point. I mean, earlier than that, they switched her to full-time. They put in Julie as part-time to handle the evidence and the reports and all that kind of stuff. So we did get it all squared away by the time it was time to start sending out the packages to prosecutors and meeting with them in the AUSA, et cetera. So, but it was an absolute total mess.
Yeah, and I think U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's forensics lab kind of got involved at that point, too, to help kind of rush through some of these IDs, right?
Very much so, yeah. We have our own DNA lab in Washington, but we had an overwhelming number of samples. So I think about half went to Ashland, to the lab there, and the other half went to ours.
So let's talk about the takedowns then. You have this date set for you by management that you have to do your takedowns. There was a little bit of a clusterfuck and a officer safety issue at those takedowns, if I remember right. How'd that play out?
Not so well.
Yeah. But you know what? The reason I want to talk about this, Todd, is not to bash anybody in particular, but I think it's a really good kind of a, I don't know, learning lesson or lesson learned kind of thing about you have to be vigilant all the way through these ops right to the end because.
We had, like you said, roughly 100 suspects, criminal suspects to be charged. Now, there weren't 100 of them in Washington. There was probably 70 or so in Washington. The rest were in New York, California, Oklahoma, et cetera. So we had 100 people. We had over 1,000 criminal charges, almost all of them felony level. And we were only going to do search warrants on the top 8 people on September 18th.
Everybody else would just be charged and like summoned into court or whatever, right?
Right. Yeah. But my whole goal on this thing was not to just get the people that sold the stuff, but I wanted to get the people that poached it and sold it to the people that sold it to us. I wanted all of it. And the way you get that is through their electronics, their phones, their computers, all that. In order to get those things, we had to have a search warrant. You're not going to get a search warrant on information that's 8 months old. So everything other than those top 8 went stale. And so no chance to do a search warrant, therefore not much of a chance to do a further dig on them, post arrest. But on that date, Jennifer and I had split up the cases 50-50. So she has half of them, I have half of them. We set up a little command center at one of our offices and we spread out all the case reports. She was on her side of the table. I was on my side. We're all ready. We told all the officers, if anything comes up, you want to know anything, call us. And so we were getting calls from the field. Everything was good. And then around noon, a friend of mine called up and said, hey, are you part of this big statewide investigation on wildlife trafficking? And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, oh, yeah, it was on the news. They have this big takedown where they're hitting up restaurants and all these people for selling wildlife, buying and selling wildlife items. And since that's your kind of thing, I just figured you were in on it. And I'm like, what channel is this? And he told me, and I looked it up, and sure as hell, there it is. Our deputy chief had taken the media to one of the search warrants. As a matter of fact, to the guy in Tacoma.
Bowery's house, yeah.
And had taken the media to that house, and they filmed everything. And they put it on the internet news before noon. And so, obviously, we had to start calling all the teams that hadn't yet served their warrants, because some teams had multiple warrants. Yakima is a good example. We had one group of people, but there was 4 people in the group, so we had to search all their places. So we had to start calling everybody that hadn't served their warrants yet and tell them there's a chance your suspect knows it's coming.
Yeah, which is a problem for 2 reasons. One is evidence is going to be disappearing, and officers might walk right into an ambush. It's an officer safety issue.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. We normally don't tell people ahead of time that we're coming.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not a good practice.
Aye, aye, aye. So how'd you handle that? You just tell everybody to just go right away, huh?
Yeah, I mean, what can you do? We just told everybody this is the deal. They may or may not know it's coming. And I think we only had one guy that we knew for sure knew it was coming.
Oh, no doubt. He got rid of all his evidence.
I say that because that one particular guy, his phone logs were deleted, everything. No text messages, no people's phone numbers. He just cleaned it, just wiped it clean. So, yeah.
But fortunately, it all ended without anybody getting shot or attacked or assaulted. But yeah,
no, it went off. There wasn't any physical confrontations whatsoever. Everybody, and we had a couple guys I was worried about. The guy, the Borny one, we had a SWAT team do it. He was a higher risk. He wasn't, in my opinion of him, he wasn't a gang member. He was a gang leader. He was the head of a organized crime gang, and he referred to his subordinates, the ones that were just kind of labor, he called them monkeys, and the ones that had more responsibilities than just labor, he called them soldiers. So we had soldiers and monkeys that he bossed around like he owned them.
Yeah. Yeah. That struck me in the book too, is right in front of these guys, he would refer to them in kind of derogatory terms. And obviously nobody's going to stand for that unless you're working for the guy or somehow otherwise kind of either out of necessity or monetary greed, you're loyal to him, right?
Yeah. And I've always wondered how well that loyalty worked after they all got arrested.
Yeah, Borey's on the hook for trusting his favorite white guy, right?
Yeah.
So
yeah, and that was a funny thing about when I said that he called us after we first met him. He called us on our way back. I think I left this part out, which is one of my favorite. At the very end of that conversation, he says, "I hope I don't regret this." And I go, "Regret what?" And he said, "Doing business with Whitey. I've never done business with Whitey before, and I hope I don't regret this."
Be fun to talk to him now, wouldn't it? Find out what his thoughts are.
Hey, good choice on the first two Whiteys you decided to deal with.
Yeah. There is so much more I kind of want to talk to you about on this case, but I think what we should say at this point is Operation Cody is available on Amazon, and it's a great read. And anybody who wants to kind of know all the details of the case and all the adventures should definitely pick up your book and give it a read. It's a great read. I enjoyed it thoroughly, so I can't recommend the book enough. This is a great operation. There are so many lessons here to be taken. I think if whether it's Washington Department of Fish and Wildlife, some other state agency, or U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, looking at this type of operation where you target a problem versus an individual person or an individual organization is really valuable. But so many takeaways from your book in terms of if an agency's going to do this, they got to commit. They got to commit the resources, the time, the money, the personnel, and the follow-up to make sure it gets all done. Because you had, like we said, 600 UC contacts, 100 suspects, 1,000 charges. You had states involved: Oklahoma, New York, Florida, Idaho, South Carolina, Oregon, Montana, California, and Illinois is what I counted. And then we didn't get into this, but you retired once the takedowns were done, and then the agency kind of didn't follow up on some of your cases in court, and that required you to kind of come back free of charge to help push that through.
Yeah.
I think, let me ask you this, Todd, from your view, I hope that you view Operation Cody as a success, because I think it was, and it was worthwhile. Maybe it didn't, some of the things didn't happen exactly the way you wanted, but I think it was a great case. Probably was a wake up call to a lot of people in the state of Washington about the consequences for being involved in wildlife crime. But what do you think were the long-term impacts of Operation Cody, and what are your thoughts on it?
I think the mere fact that we illustrated what's going on in Washington's nothing special in that regard, I'm sure that similar activities are occurring in every state in the country and every province in Canada. These problems are not local problems. They're not, you're probably not going to sell a lot of gallbladders if you live in a town full of Mennonites in Pennsylvania. In most jurisdictions, there's bear gallbladder going on. There's deer and elk meat. We did a lot of raptors. That stuff's going on everywhere. And so I hope that the best takeaway from it was that other agencies, other jurisdictions, and even people in our agency, because everybody's new now. I mean, it's a whole new squad. We got a new chief. He's a great guy. New deputy chief. He's a great guy. So things are, you know, wiped the slate clean, essentially. Jennifer, my partner, is now a captain. She's the captain of the largest region in the state. So everything has changed, and in my opinion, has changed for the better. And I just wanted to educate everybody as to what is most likely happening right there in your jurisdiction, too. So,
yeah, and pay attention to what you're kind of hearing through the grapevine among other enforcement officers, because it'll be a clue about what problems need to be attacked. And then this type of operation is a real good example of the creative approach that you can take to try to tackle a problem versus an individual violator, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, I love it. I can't tell you how much I appreciate you being on the program to talk about it. And thank you so much for the work you did. When did you retire?
2012, the end of December 31st, 2012.
Right at the conclusion of Operation Cody, right?
Yep. A couple months. It's during November, December, 3 months later. Yeah.
Well, a fantastic operation and a fantastic career, Todd. I hope you're proud of everything you were accomplished.
Thank you. And I appreciate your support.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for being on the show. I appreciate it. Maybe we'll have you back sometime. I know you've got 100 other stories you could tell us. And everybody else, thanks for joining us. We'll see you next time. Nature's Secret Service is written and produced by me, Ed Newcomer, and is co-produced by the DHTV team here at California State University, Dominguez Hills. Follow us on social media and connect with us online at naturessecretservice.com.